Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here with another episode of the Paleo Solution Podcast. We are here today with my very good friend and functional medicine expert, ninja of all things, biofilm related, Dr. Michael Ruscio. Doc, I don't know if I told you, but your first podcast was actually one of the most popular podcasts that we've had. So welcome back to the show.
Cool. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. I'm super stoked. We have a ton of ground to cover here, but I want to hammer out our podcast sponsors super quick. FrontDeskHQ.com is your mobile-based solution for service-based businesses. Dog walking, CrossFitting, Yoga-ing, Pilata-ing. You will love Front Desk. Check out those folks. They can set you up with a demo if you have not done that already. Well Foods, wellfoodco.com. This is a fantastic outfit if you want to track down some great gluten-free snack options, gluten-free grass-fed jerky, almond cookies. They are cookies, folks. Don't dress them up for anything other than that, but they are delicious, and I travel with them all the time. Performance Menu, the Journal of Nutrition Athletic Excellence, performancemenu.com. You've got a $30 per year subscription, which gives you access to all the to the current issues in a variety of formats. $100 a year gives you access to all the back issues, as well as 10% off, or excuse me, 15% off in the Catalyst Athletic store. Masa Meats, go to masanaturalmeats.com. These are the folks that I get my grass-fed meat from. They are outstanding. They're located outside of Orland, California. They ship all over the lower, or I guess the continental 48, as it were. Caveman Coffee, go to cavemancoffeeco.com, enter the discount code ROBWOLF, and you get a 10% off as well. We will be donating 10% of sales to the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Finally, Hylete.com. Hylete is just a fantastic athletic clothing provider. I was one of the early adopters on these folks. If you enter the discount code RW25, you get a 25% off of your purchase. So there you have it. Okay, all that stuff's done. Doc, what's cracking? What's new?
Well, the least medical related thing, I started doing a fencing class about 5 weeks ago, and it's actually pretty fun.
Really? What got you into that?
I just saw like a Living Social come through, and I said, geez, this sounds fun. So I shot a note to a buddy of mine, and we've been doing it for about 5 weeks, and it's fun, and we have an instructor who's kind of like a Chris Farley Saturday Night Live character, so it's just perfect.
Nice, right on. So are you doing foils, saber, epee? What are you using?
Yeah, we're using foils, and you know, we have like the mask and the jacket and all that jazz, and you know, the first week or two is all footwork, and then when we finally started getting the chance to spar or to fence, it's pretty fun. It's actually a great workout too.
Yeah, yeah. I did a tiny bit of that actually when I was boxing and kickboxing, because my boxing coach was actually a student of Ed Parker, who was the Kempo, one of the big Kempo karate guys. He actually gave a black belt to Elvis Presley, oddly enough. And but Parker was actually a really big fan of fencing and all the angles and the parries and stuff like that involved in fencing, and he felt like there was some really good applications with boxing. I sucked sufficiently at boxing that I could never really get it to transfer over. I was more of a catcher's mitt than a intercontinental ballistic missile, but that's super cool.
Yeah. How about you? What's going on your end?
Not a whole heck of a lot. You know, we're 20 weeks pregnant here, so gearing up for a second wolf cub to arrive. Working like crazy on the cert, trying to get that thing done before all hell breaks loose in late July, early August, going to jiu-jitsu and just waiting for spring to really spring. And in Reno yesterday, it's been totally schizophrenic weather. We had snow, sleet in the morning, and then it was 62 degrees by the afternoon and sunny, and
wow.
I actually got a little bit of a tan, so yeah. So it's been
kind of like a bipolar climate you got going on there.
Absolutely, which high desert, that's pretty much part and parcel for that stuff. So, yeah. So, you know, Doc, when you were on the show last time, we had a ton of folks interested in biofilms. I know you and I talked a little bit about that. We had talked a little bit about digging into some thyroid dysregulation. Where do you want to jump in on this?
Well, maybe we can jump in with thyroid, because There's some interesting stuff about iodine I'd like to talk about, because I know that's a controversial issue. And then maybe we can segue over to biofilms and then use that as a bridge to go into some other GI research that I think is pretty interesting.
Very cool. That sounds good.
So regarding iodine, I'm sure people have probably heard different opinions on iodine, and I think there's kind of two polarized camps. One camp, kind of like the Guy Abraham camp, iodine is great for everything. Everybody with any kind of health condition should be on iodine. If you have hypothyroid, you want to be on iodine, and you want to be on high doses, milligram doses of iodine. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's kind of the new age, sort of the Tease Karazian inspired, iodine can provoke autoimmunity and you should always avoid iodine, when you have any kind of thyroid autoimmunity. And I think the actual truth of that lies somewhere in the middle. And I just wrapped up writing the chapter on iodine for the book, which I may just end up releasing via my blog because, while it's kind of long for a blog, but it's just really important information, and I'd rather get it out to people sooner rather than later. But I'll kind of give you the synopsis, and I want to thank Dr. Jeffrey Moss, who's over at Moss Nutrition, because he wrote an excellent, excellent series on iodine. He spent about 2 years just reviewing a lot of the iodine literature and writing very, very objectively, very non-biased. So his work was instrumental, and then, of course, I did a lot of fact-checking and kind of compare and contrast that with my own clinical research. So I guess I'll just jump right in, and with any questions, let me know. But I think it's been pretty well borne out by the literature that iodine increases thyroid autoimmunity. And there's really no debate on that. If you look at the literature, gosh, you really cannot refute that. And I've had a few people reach out and say, I've uncovered some information that is contrary to that line of thinking. So I'm saying iodine.
Let me ask you a question really quick. What are the forms of iodine that we're talking about here? Like from kelp, from getting it from like sweetmeats, or you know, like have all these things been kind of normalized for the form of iodine as well as the dosage?
Well, the most compelling data we have is when we add iodine to a food supply to help increase iodine levels in a population. So, and usually that's iodide, but there have been a number of studies using supplemental either iodide or iodine. And interestingly, when some of the researchers, and a lot of this research comes out of Asian countries that consume a high amount of seaweed, they've actually shown that seaweed is probably one of the most autoimmunogenic, if you will, forms of iodine. So
interesting.
I was thinking that, you know, it's natural, it's probably the, you know, the safest, but some of the papers are actually showing the converse, or the inverse of that. So it seems like iodide is the least potential to cause autoimmunity, although some studies in fibrocystic breast disease with women who had fibrocystic breast disease and Hashimoto's have used iodine, and as long as they stay under a certain threshold dose, they seem to be okay. So you can probably get away with either iodide or iodine, but it seems like iodide is probably safer. And it does. There are some studies that have shown, for example, there's something known as endemic coastal goiter, where people who live close to the ocean eat a lot of seaweed, and there's something there's iodine-induced goiter that can occur there.
Interesting, which is totally counter to what you would see with somebody living, you know, like internal like India or something like that, and they have a goiter induced from super low iodine levels.
Well, the interesting thing is that apparently either high or low iodine can cause goiter.
Interesting. Okay, I was totally unaware of that. Wow.
Yeah, and so the researchers have shown that by reducing seaweed intake, they can have a pretty strong impact on reducing both goiter and autoimmunity in some of these patients. So yeah, the high iodine can cause hypothyroidism through autoimmunity and also through non-autoimmune mechanisms.
Hmm.
So, back to the point that I was driving at before, there are numerous, numerous population studies that have shown when we add iodine to the population, we see goiter go down, but we also see autoimmune thyroiditis increase. And I think the important thing to look at when people are trying to, you know, figure out which one of these lines of thinking is actually correct, you've got to look at large scale studies compared to small studies. And a lot of times when people want to say, well, iodine's good, look at this, you know, in vivo study where they gave rats this, or they did a cell line culture study with that. You can't really put that kind of evidence above looking at 3,500 people over 10 years after adding iodine to the food supply.
So like an example of that would be when like the United States started adding iodine to the table salt supply in pretty aggressive fashion.
Exactly. And then you would just look at, you know, the thousands of people that were monitored in that particular study and see what the outcome was. That kind of evidence really has much more weight than saying we did a short scale study with 10 rats or something like that. So yeah, I think that's been pretty well bore out. But the other interesting thing on the other side of the coin is one of the mechanisms through which the paleo diet may help with thyroid autoimmunity outside of the typical avoiding food antigens like gluten and dairy may be because it's a low iodine diet. And I think a lot of people haven't really realized this, and I didn't really fully appreciate this until I dove into some of the research. But let's look at the top sources of iodine in most food supplies. Iodized salt, which most paleoers are going to go to sea salt, which is not iodized and actually has a very, very low amount of iodine, relatively speaking to iodized salt, then dairy, then bread, and then also seaweed. And then eggs actually are another source. So if people are doing the autoimmune protocol, they're definitely cutting out dairy, bread, and eggs. And those are three of the maybe five top sources of dietary iodine.
Interesting. You know, because I actually had, thought that it would make sense to, you know, get like some powdered kelp or something and throw that in some soups and stews every once in a while just to kind of hedge our bets on that. But that may actually not be the smartest route to go with this. And then it's interesting, we've usually looked at some of the immunogenic proteins in almost anti-nutrient type constituents in eggs. But maybe that's barking up the wrong tree. It may be that we're reducing iodine input from that vector. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I was really, really kind of surprised when I put that all together. And I think for a lot of people, some dietary iodine through kelp and things like that will probably be okay. But if you have Hashimoto's or any kind of thyroid autoimmunity, you probably want to be careful with that. And I would strongly consider a low iodine diet for those people, because there have been some studies even where they've put people on a high iodine diet, they've seen hypothyroidism occur, they've taken them off of the high iodine diet, hypothyroidism has gone away, and then they put them back on it again, and hypothyroidism has come back. And that kind of stuff is really compelling, because, I mean, it's really hard to argue with that sort of evidence.
So what, you know, and I guess this will probably vary from, say, like a healthy non-autoimmune individual to somebody who's actually experiencing these symptoms, but what's a safe iodine level that folks should be shooting for? And again, it sounds like this may vary quite a bit.
Well, some of the research has shown that about the upper tolerable limit is about 1,100 micrograms. Or 1 milligram. So that's probably a reasonable intake that people will be okay with. Now, for people who are trying to do a low iodine diet and kind of test this to see if it could be beneficial for them, it's usually under about 100 micrograms a day. Hmm. So, that's kind of the range for what you have to work in. But about 1,100 micrograms is the safe operable limit. And then in clinical studies, they've shown that as long as you are under about 10 to 15 milligrams a day, that seems to be kind of like the safe upper limit for repleting the dose. So that would be considered a higher intake of iodine, right? 10 to 15 milligrams, not micrograms, milligrams of iodine is way higher than the RDA.
Right.
And so that seems to be safe. It's just the pro-iodine camp sometimes recommends 50 milligrams a day plus. And that's where you start to see these things like hypothyroidism,
whether it be fed by autoimmunity or just because of taking too much iodine. So that's when these things really seem problematic, is when you go too high in the dose.
Interesting. Okay. And again, like usually the only populations that we would see with a dose that high would be folks that are consuming seaweed as part of a traditional diet, and they're just getting a ton of iodine from that.
Yeah, that would be the most so, or then the health nut who has symptoms of hypothyroidism and decides to go on iodine, and they've been taking iodine for 5 years and never questioned it, but still don't feel very well.
Right. And I mean, it's generally contraindicated for folks to who have Hashimoto's to supplement with iodine. I think from the the mainstream kind of medical thing, but to your point, there are folks out there that say no, you should be taking much more. But then you seem to be making a pretty strong case that the folks that are recommending these I think it's easy to say that these would be super physiological levels, that there may there may be some concern for that type of recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely. And two quick notes to that. I know last time I came on, people were asking for some of the references. So what I'll do is eventually I'll try to put some of this information out via the newsletter, because all the references are in the book. It's hard to sit here and
rattle through them all. Sure.
Yeah. Sure. So and I do apologize for people who've been saying, "Geez, whatever happened to Dr. Russo's newsletter? I haven't put one out in probably 3 months. I've just been absolutely enamored with stuff at the clinic, but I'm getting back on the horse here, and we'll have some stuff coming out soon." The other thing I wanted to touch on really quick is there's something known as a sodium iodine supporter, and that I think really helps us understand why especially some people seem to do okay with iodine and other people seem to really react negatively to it, because we do know, like I just said, that for some people iodine is going to be very very detrimental. Other people seem to do okay with it, however. And one of the things that I think helps answer that discordance is the sodium iodine supporter. And the sodium iodine supporter is it's the doorway for iodine to get into the thyroid gland. And it helps regulate iodine levels in the thyroid. So if your intake of iodine is low, the sodium iodine supporter will increase absorption. If your intake is high, then the sodium iodine supporter will decrease absorption. So it's a protective and a regulatory mechanism to make sure that your whatever's in the thyroid in terms of iodine is the right levels. But if that doorway, if that regulatory mechanism gets disrupted, then you can't regulate. And interestingly, inflammation and toxins are the two most common things that can derange function of that doorway. So when people are ill, they should really make using iodine one of the last things they do, because if you're ill, the likelihood of inflammation is extremely high, and there's also a fair likelihood of some kind of toxicity. So you want to get rid of those factors first, so that let's say if you start an iodine treatment program, if it's too much or too little for your body, your sodium iodine supporter will help be able to regulate your levels. I don't know if that's too deep.
No. It totally makes sense. And you see a little. This is maybe a little bit of a stretch for an analogy, but folks will oftentimes they'll get some blood work done, and their ferritin levels will be very, very high, and then there will be some concern that their blood iron may be too high. Folks may recommend that they undergo some phlebotomy, some blood donation. But actually what's happening is that this person is sick, they have an infection, or they have some gut permeability, which is causing ferritin to sequester iron away, because not only do we use iron for growth, but pathogens use iron for growth as well. And this is where like some well-meaning like World Health Organization people went into like sub-Saharan Africa, found all these people who looked like they were anemic, gave them iron boluses, and these people died from infectious breakout because they had overwhelmed their body's ability to get that iron away, and then these pathogens were able to thrive. So the body has a host of different protective mechanisms to try to keep whether it's iron or whether it's iodine within normal operating parameters. And what you're saying, which again, this is something that I was unaware of, if we have some systemic inflammation it may actually dysregulate that SIM porter, which would normally keep iodine within certain parameters. But then, you know, we could, let's say, have some gut permeability from gluten or from some, this is where it gets to me really interesting, shift work, stress, a whole variety of other things. And then you actually could take an individual that wasn't in a position to have thyroid dysregulation from abnormal iodine levels, and now they will because of say like gut permeability, and the gut permeability could come from a variety of factors, whether it's overtraining, lack of sleep, or like some sort of gut irritant like a gluten or dairy.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
And the same thing kind of applies with iron. You really can't look at high ferritin and make any definitive conclusions for that. You have to look at the total iron binding capacity, serum iron, and also maybe their liver markers like ALT and AST, and then you can look at those and you can say, okay, is this a pattern that is suggestive of hemochromatosis, say, or is it not? You know, and you can also run the soluble transferrin receptor to help elucidate whether or not this is high ferritin induced by an infection or not. So yeah, it's context is extremely, extremely important, and that's one of the challenges with some of the educated patients that I deal with. They, you know, they know just enough to be dangerous, right?
Right.
Where, like, I highly, highly applaud people going out there and researching these things, but even for a clinician, these decisions can be challenging. And for a clinician, this is all you do all day, every day.
Right.
So if you're just doing this as a hobby, yeah, it's tough.
You get in the deep end of the pool rather quickly. Yeah, I had some kind of weird inflammatory markers in my blood work, and we saw high ferritin, and this was probably two and a half years ago. Saw some high ferritin, followed up on doing like the iron saturation and all the rest of that stuff because we were curious if maybe I had some iron overload. That ended up not being the case, but then we dug deeper and we actually found that my TSH had inched up over time, and even though it was still on the lower end of normal for the population, it had more than doubled. It was heading towards like 2.5 times higher what I had historically run at. And so then we did some different protocols to help with both adrenals and the thyroid, and then those other inflammatory markers ended up going down, and then I generally started feeling a lot better.
Yeah, the context is huge. One thing on the same along the same lines, Rob, is if someone does see the iron piece and they're a little bit, you know, worried about it, to evaluate if you have hemochromatosis or potentially hemochromatosis. If you see serum iron high and your percent transferrin saturation high, your ferritin high, and then your liver enzymes high, along with a low TIBC, that's fairly diagnostic of hemochromatosis. Or even if you see your percent transferrin saturation and ferritin high together, you know, that's when you want to start maybe being concerned about hemochromatosis. If not, if it's just a high ferritin and nothing else is funky, like you were alluding to before, see if there's anything else going on, like any gut inflammation, a potential infection, food allergies, what have you. Take care of that first, retest the ferritin, see if it's come down.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Doc, so you know, what are some of the clinical manifestations of this thyroid story? Like, what when folks wander into your office, have they already been kind of fishing around with the thyroid issues, or are they coming in with some just like general malaise? And then when you're doing your basic blood work, that's where this stuff pops up. Like, how are you interfacing with this, and how are people becoming aware of it?
For the population of patients in my practice that have thyroid issues, I'd say maybe 60% know they have a thyroid problem or are highly suspicious of a thyroid, probably more like 70% actually, either know they have a thyroid problem or are highly suspicious. But the way to view thyroid, and this is one of the things I have to constantly educate my patients about, is the thyroid doesn't just malfunction arbitrarily, right? There's always a reason why. And oftentimes, the most important thing you can do, ironically, coming back to the gut, is address
a gut health issue, because that's going to be the primary source of inflammation. That's also going to be the primary source of perturbing the immune system. So, you know, it's like sometimes I feel like a broken record where people come in and they're on level thyroxine and they still don't feel well. They still have all these symptoms of hypothyroidism. And they're thinking, well, is there another drug you'd recommend, or should I be on Cytomel along with this? And they're really just hell-bent on chasing the symptoms. And oftentimes the first thing I'll say is, well, how's your digestion? I'm constipated. I have a lot of gas. Okay. Well, we need to have a look there first, because most likely that's going to be perturbing the thyroid. And oftentimes we don't even have to adjust the medication once we get some of these other gastrointestinal issues situated.
Interesting. Very cool.
But then some of the other things, Rob, sorry to cut you off.
No.
Some of the other things that we will look at, depending on the person, is we may look at their iodine levels, because some people may need some iodine. And we'll do a 24-hour urine iodine with creatinine ratio, which I think is by far and away the best evaluation for iodine levels, because you don't want to do a spot urine, because that can be misleading. So you want to collect urine for 24 hours, which gives you a good indication. And then also you want to have that relative to the creatinine ratio, because essentially if the volume of your of what's coming out in your urine is abnormally high or low, it's going to throw off the iodine reading. So when you index it to creatinine, you get a more accurate gauge. I know that the iodine absorption test is one that is maybe kind of popular in the holistic community, but if you read the iodine literature, that test is never mentioned. It's only mentioned by one group of iodine advocates, and even when you look at it, the levels and the values used to set up the parameters of that test were completely arbitrarily
established.
Yeah. Right. So not to say that it doesn't have any clinical utility, but I think to really track your true iodine status and look at what the iodine researchers, the epidemiologists are using and the public health people are using, the 24-hour urinary iodine with creatinine ratio is going to be the way to go.
Very cool. Very cool. And again, using that creatinine, it's basically giving you a sense of what a glomerular filtration rate is, so you know whether or not, you know, the just the total throughput of the kidneys, and then that gives you an actual index of what the iodine status is. Because we could have somebody who's dehydrated or hyperhydrated, and so this gives us a benchmark for figuring that out.
Exactly. And it's not absolutely perfect, but it's the best one that we have of the testing that's available.
Cool. So how does this dovetail over into biofilms now? Since folks just lost their minds over biofilms, like people were going to start making Dr. Ruscio biofilm T-shirts and stuff for their last show.
All right, I'll get one of those. With biofilms, and I think I did a video shortly after the last time we spoke called Updates on Biofilms, and I've got a few cool slides here that I'll probably be presenting at the Paleo Effects on Biofilms. But essentially, biofilms, as I understand it, were first recognized when prosthetic implants were being put in, because that was an issue with some of these prostheses. And then also in the mouth. Those were the two. You have dental biofilms and then surgical biofilms. And as we started to learn more about them, we started realizing that biofilms have their hand in a number of different kind of infections. In fact, I'm looking at a review article from the Journal of Alimentary Pharmacology and Therapeutics, where they have a nice table showing it's implicated with device-related infections, with periodontitis, with chronic UTIs, with cystic fibrosis, with bronchitis, with otitis media, with chronic wounds, chronic rhinosinusitis. And then, of course, there's other literature showing it with many different gastrointestinal infections and even some of the Lyme and Lyme disease-associated co-infections. So maybe one of the most basic things before I get, too deep here, is a quick preface on biofilms. Essentially,
the way it plays out is like this. When an infection first gets in your body, it's in what's called planktonic form. So think like plankton in the ocean, just kind of dispersed all over the place. When you're at that phase of the infection, they're relatively easy to treat because they're out in the open. You know, it's like if you were like a sniper or something and someone was just walking down the street, you know, easy target. When the infection becomes more chronic, they form these biofilms. So they tend to aggregate, you know, against walls, in corners, so to speak. And all these different fungus and or bacteria, they can actually all aggregate together. And then they secrete these things called quorum sensing molecules. And they're essentially like little signals they send out to see who's around them. And when you get enough quorum sensing signaling to figure out, hey, there's a bunch of us here, they start to build this protective film over them that is highly impenetrable to antibiotics or herbal antimicrobials. So that changes the game. And what you see in some of the published literature is different researchers are saying, hey, we need to look at how we treat chronic infections differently, because once you leave the planktonic phase, the game changes, and just using an antibiotic is not highly efficacious because we haven't accounted for the biofilm. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, when in a biofilm, these different bacteria or fungus, they can actually participate in what's called horizontal gene transfer, where they can actually transfer resistant genes or other genes that are ideal for survival from one to another. And different members of the biofilm can all work cooperatively to achieve different protective functions. Some may distract the immune system or suppress the immune system. Others may participate in building of the film. So that's kind of some of the basics. Some of the more relevant stuff, there's a great study here from the Journal of Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology in 2010, where they had two groups of 20 patients. I'm sorry, I should say there was 40 patients that had chronic H. pylori infection, even after multiple rounds of antibiotics. So they decided to treat one more time, and they divided the group up into two different subgroups. 20 would just have another antibiotic, and this was actually a DNA-specific antibiotic. So they cultured the H. pylori to find out what would it be most susceptible to in terms of an antibiotic. That group just got the antibiotic. The other group was pretreated with N-acetylcysteine and then had the antibiotic. Now, here's the interesting thing. In the only antibiotic group, only 4 out of 20 cleared the infection. In the pretreatment with NAC plus the antibiotic, 12 out of 20 cleared the infection. So just a simple pretreatment with N-acetylcysteine, which is a mucolytic agent, helps break down the mucus of the biofilm, was able to vastly, about threefold, increase the ability of an antibiotic to kill the infection. So the big takeaway from that is when you get rid of the biofilm, the infection is much more susceptible to treatment. Whether it be antibiotic or herbal, I would strongly speculate that it would make a big difference as long as you addressed the biofilm.
And if one had good levels of these anti-biofilm agents as part of the diet or even a supplementation, say like if you're traveling, like I'm kind of prone to a chronic sinus infection, so maybe that would be a time to supplement with the N-acetylcysteine and might that help prevent the propagation of the biofilm to start off with, and then allow your own immune response to kind of do what it does?
Well, it depends, right? If you're trying to stop a newly acquired infection, then my opinion, and again, this is just my opinion, I haven't read anything published on this one way or the other, but in my opinion, for a new infection, it's not really that important because you're going to be in the planktonic state, right? Mm-hmm. So probably more important for a chronic infection. If you were traveling and you were, you know, concerned about sinusitis and you wanted to take some antimicrobials along with some N-acetylcysteine for a couple weeks, yeah, it's probably not going to be a big deal. Would it be absolutely necessary? I'm not sure.
Gotcha. Gotcha. But that's where like basic sinus rinsing and good hygiene and all that stuff helps with that. But that's super interesting. What are some other agents, either pharmaceutical or nutraceutical, that are commonly used to help break up the biofilms? I mean, are they swizzling people with a detergent or something like that? Or I mean, how are they tackling this?
Well, what works best is if you lay down and you have someone burn sage over you.
Perfect.
And then you do. No, I'm just kidding.
So I need to move back to Humboldt then, is what you're saying.
Exactly. You know, N-acetylcysteine has been shown to be effective for H. pylori in a couple clinical trials, and also for chronic sinusitis, rhinosinusitis sort of thing. So that's where the best evidence seems to lie with NAC for that. Now, for gastrointestinal infections, you can use chelating agents. You can also use, of course, N-acetylcysteine. What I like to do is use something called Interface Plus through Claire Labs, which has got a combination of some chelating agents, some antimucolytics, and some protein degrading enzymes. And oftentimes I'll use that along with maybe some N-acetylcysteine or along with Cemento. And Cemento, the best evidence for Cemento, comes from some studies with Borrelia or with Lyme disease. But I've seen with a few patients it worked phenomenally well for fungal biofilms. The other nice thing about Cemento is it can increase a fraction of white blood cells, which you know, of course, if people have low white blood cells, that can be helpful. So there's a number of things that you can use. Different ones I personalize to different patients. If someone's got a history of more what I think may be H. pylori and or some sort of sinus biofilm, I'll use NAC, especially if they have neurological complications, because NAC is very good at helping to heal the blood-brain barrier. If it's a more gut central issue, I'll use Interphase and then maybe Cemento along with it. If I'm suspicious of Lyme or one of the Lyme co-infections, I'll definitely use Cemento along with it. There are some new kind of novel agents that I'm considering fooling around with. Salvadora persica is a herb that can inhibit quorum sensing molecules. So I don't know how clinically relevant that's going to be, but quorum sensing isn't really adequately addressed with any of the other items that I mentioned. I've had success nonetheless, but I'll be curious to fool around with some of the Salvadora and see if that has any additional effect. And silver can also help, curcumin can help. There's a lot of things that can help, but those are just some of my kind of favorites.
Very cool. Doc, what else? What else do you want to cover today?
Well, I've got a really cool slide here I'm going to put out in one of the next newsletters, where you can see a biofilm pre and post treatment. They actually did a scanning electron micrograph, and it's really cool because you can actually visually see the biofilm and see how it changes with treatment. So that's just a little anecdote. More on along the lines of gastrointestinal stuff, I shot you a slide I put together from the Journal of Nutritional Reviews, and I thought this was really interesting, and I'm going to be speaking with the author of this study to try to get some more information. But they did intestinal biopsies of two different groups of mice, ones that were raised in germ-free or sterile conditions and ones that were raised in germy or more kind of natural conditions. And it was really interesting to see that the intestinal architecture changed based on the conditions. When mice were raised in germ-free conditions, the villi were actually thinner and longer. And when they were raised in germ-containing environments, the villi were shorter and fatter. Now, what does that mean? Well, when you have a long, thin villi, you have increased surface area. And here's the interesting twist. Increased surface area will allow you to absorb more calories from your food and leave you more susceptible to infection.
Mm-hmm.
So in a germ-filled condition,
the villi become shorter and fatter. They can't absorb as much calories, but they do that because they are less prone to infection. So that's a really interesting mechanism that I haven't heard mentioned yet. A lot of the research is focused on the microbiota, and this population does this and that population does that, and that's very, very interesting. This speaks to something entirely different, which is, you know, the amount and the diversity of the flora will actually change intestinal architecture.
Nutrient absorption and also pathogenic risks. And, you know, it's interesting, in celiac, one of the primary response is a flattening of the villi, like they just virtually go away.
Sure, sure. And that mechanism, I'm thinking, is a little different because that's autoimmune.
Right.
But
it's almost like burning the boats, you know. It's like, yeah, if there is, you know, there's clearly a response there, and then maybe to some degree there's some sort of kind of evolutionary holdover where an infection like that, even though a celiac isn't an infection, but something that's causing that type of inflammation, then there's actually a pruning back of the villi to try to mitigate other problems.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very insightful point. Yeah, that could be.
Interesting. Cool. Well, Doc, what else do you want to cover here? I just kind of wanted to open the floor to you and see what you were up sure. to and do a check-in. I know folks are going to love this stuff.
Well, yeah, a couple other quick things, and I've got so much in my head right now, Rob. I can talk for like the next 5 hours. So just feel free to cut me off, hit mute, hang up, you know, whenever you're sick of me. But there, in terms of testing for gut infections, without giving any names, there is a really predominant lab that I'm sure everybody knows that specializes in DNA testing for infections. And it was a lab that I use, but I'm using much less of, because there was a report, an investigation published by a PhD at Loyola University. And what they did, and this really shocked me, they took healthy people, they took stool from 34 healthy people and then spiked it with infections. And they spiked it with what would be considered clinically relevant level, so enough that it's definitely considered a pathogenic infection, and they sent them to this lab, and the results were pretty remarkable. 15 of the 34 were reported as no ovum parasites, so clear.
Wow.
Of the remaining 19, 17 were reported as a parasite that we can't identify. Which means, the standard response to that is it may be a transient passerby, it may be some kind of non-pathogenic infection, we don't know. You know, it may or may not be a good idea to treat. And then for three, the infections were actually found. So there's been some changes in this lab over the past few months. I'm not sure if it was because of this paper, but the validity of that testing in clinical practice has not been fully established. And you know, I have to admit that I was so excited about the potential that I just kind of went with it, and I didn't really resist it. But after seeing this, it makes me much more speculative about new testing compared to older testing.
That's right and true, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, and I have noticed with a number of patients, I'll be scratching my head because there's clear gastrointestinal involvement even after going on a healthy diet, yet these screenings all come back negative. So I'm definitely suspicious, and hopefully that helps some people who may know what lab it is I'm talking about. And the lab has made some changes, so I think they're trying to do their best. But for what it's worth, without being too much of a negative Nancy, that's something that people may want to be aware of. Something else I've been doing a lot of research into is butyrate. Are you familiar with butyrate, Rob?
It both from a gut bacterial, fermentation, then also potentially getting it a direct dietary source. Sure.
Sure. Okay. So I've got some stuff on butyrate, and then if we have time, maybe some stuff on SIBO. But essentially, butyrate is a short-chain fatty acid. It's made by the commensal bacteria, predominantly in our colon, after fermentation of soluble fibers. And I've been looking at butyrate as a potential clinical tool for IBD, because in IBD, irritable bowel disease, most common manifestations are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. In those diseases, one of the things that we want to do is increase short-chain fatty acid production like butyrate. So how do you do that? Well, you have fiber. But the challenge is that oftentimes these people's guts are so sensitive they can't really tolerate much fiber. Mm-hmm. So I started to speculate, well, what if we gave butyrate, because butyrate can help heal. And then once the intestines were more robust, more resilient, we can segue off butyrate and then go to fiber, and the fiber will help keep the short-chain fatty acid production up. So as I started looking into this, there's actually some very interesting research with supplemental butyrate. Usually it's the form of sodium butyrate or magnesium butyrate or butyrate L-carnitine. But in one review, 7 of 9 studies showed a positive change using butyrate in ulcerative colitis. So 7 of 9 studies is pretty remarkable. The sample sizes were small, and there was no control group. So we can't, you know, have too much of a party just yet. But that's a nice benefit to be able to show things like reduced remission, positive histological change on intestinal biopsy from butyrate, whereas the other option are some of these immunosuppressive drugs, which, you know, even the conventional gastroenterology literature says are not the best options because of the side effect profile.
Right.
There was one study with Crohn's disease that showed some good impact, some positive impact with butyrate. And some of the things that butyrate does is it's anti-inflammatory. It acts as fuel for the enterocytes or for the intestinal cells, mainly in the colon. It's been shown to help decrease polyps and potentially decrease colon cancer. Another really interesting thing is it helps potentiate what's called the ileal brake. So you have the ileocecal transition, so the last segment of the small intestine to the first segment of the large intestine. And there's the ileocecal valve that helps to make sure that contents from the large intestine don't reflux into the small intestine. And that's one of the things that can cause SIBO. And butyrate has actually been shown to facilitate what's called the ileal brake, which is essentially helps turn on the ileocecal valve so that stuff from the colon can't reflux into the large intestine, because you don't want stuff from the colon getting back into the large intestine. And the main reason for that is the bacterial counts in the colon are about 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 15, whereas the bacterial counts in the small intestine are about 10 to the 0 to 10 to the 3. So there's so much more bacteria in the colon, they shouldn't be getting into the small intestine. One of the things that helps prevent that is this ileal brake or the ileocecal valve, which is enhanced through butyrate. Another thing that's noteworthy is there's something called G-protein-coupled receptors, or GPRs, and they help alter the immune surveillance toward colonic microflora. And in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, but more so in Crohn's disease, one of the mechanisms, one of the pathophysiological mechanisms, is the body starts attacking commensal flora. That's why one of the lab markers used to diagnose Crohn's is the Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibodies, because you start attacking your own commensal Saccharomyces population. So butyrate has been shown to help with these G-protein coupled receptors that help modulate how aggressively your immune system targets your own good flora. So is any of that making sense?
Yeah, totally. So okay. Would a dietary source, you know, like a pastured butter, Would that be an option, or do we really need some sort of like an isolated, like butyrate salt, like you mentioned?
Well, my thinking is, and maybe you can tell me specifically, the clinical studies have used about 4 grams per day, and I'm assuming to get that through a dietary source is going to be near impossible.
Gotcha. Okay.
But maybe the best way, like a lot of my clinical approach, is we use the sodium butyrate for a short period of time. We get someone healed up, and then their maintenance is increased soluble fiber and increased butyrate containing things like butter.
Okay.
So I think that would probably be the most reasonable approach.
And then what are your preferred fiber sources? You know, like a resistant starch has had kind of a revival or a discovery within the paleo scene lately, and folks have used like a potato starch, tapioca starch. What are your preferred kind of sources for goosing that endogenous butyrate production?
Sure. Well, that's something I'm really intimately researching right now, and I haven't come to any definitive conclusions, but I think a mixture is probably going to be the best, because different studies show that, you know, this inulin, for example, will feed fecal bacterium P, which is shown to help prevent the relapse of Crohn's. So inulin, I think, is good. You have different FODMAP containing prebiotics, but then the challenge there is people with IBS don't really tolerate FODMAPs. So the direct answer to your question before I get on too much of a tangent is I think there's going to be some individualization that's going to be necessary.
Sure.
Short term, you're probably going to have to clean up some stuff before you can go very heavy with the prebiotics. And then when you get things cleaned up initially, probably the best approach is going to be a mixture of a variety of types of prebiotics, with maybe some special consideration to the FODMAP prebiotics, and just trying to sniff out which ones may not be well tolerated for you.
Damn customization and lack of a one-size-fits-all approach. I'm deleting this thing. This podcast is worthless.
Get rid of it. I would burn it if you could. But the other thing there, just to reiterate, is as I think the most hazardous thing maybe you want to be careful with is just the FODMAP containing prebiotics, because the low FODMAP approach has been shown to be very effective in clinical trials for IBS, very effective. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that when people avoid FODMAPs for 4 to 8 weeks, their FODMAP tolerance increases. So it's kind of like you're saying, like with a lot of the other stuff, come off of these foods that may be noxious, let your intestines heal a bit, and then start reintroducing. And
see,
usually,
what you can do.
Yeah, usually you'll be a little bit more tolerant. And then one other thing, sorry to have a run-on sentence here, but with going back to butyrate for a minute, I just want to make one caution. There is something known as a butyrate paradox, which essentially states, and this is not 100% conclusive, but it seems that people with healthy intestinal tissue respond negatively, or may, I should say may, because this is not conclusive, but people with healthy intestinal tissue may respond negatively to butyrate, but people with pathological intestinal tissue, IBD, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, respond favorably. I just want to throw out that qualifier, because I don't want people who are fairly healthy, but how can I get that last inch of performance? Let me try butyrate. I don't think it's for that population.
Interesting. That's a fantastic point, because I would have been that person that would go out and start snorting sodium butyrate or something. So yeah. Well, Doc, I am somewhat double booked today, so we're gonna have to trim it there, because I am rolling into kid duty here in mere moments. But let folks know where they can track you down, both your YouTube channel and your website.
Sure. So my website is drrusciocom, just drrusciocom. And keep your eye on that site, because it's going to be completely revamped in the next month. I'm going to have a clinic store with kind of like a do-it-yourself home treatment section to help people who maybe can't afford to work with a functional medicine doctor. The YouTube page is YouTube.com/MichaelRusciò. And then I did launch a thyroid specific site that's paleothyroid.com.
Oh, nice. You didn't tell me about this. What the hell?
Sorry. You know, I'm blackballing you, Rob.
Okay. Man, nobody tells me anything anymore.
And on that site, I try to get everything up there as neatly as possible. There's some things that are a little bit out of whack, but the first several chapters of my book are there as kind of a preview, and then there's a video version of each chapter all on thyroid. So that's that. And then the newsletter, like I said, if you guys go to drrusha.com and sign up for the newsletter, I will be getting back on the horse with that to try to keep people abreast with all this stuff. And I'll be speaking at PaleoFX. I'm looking forward to that. I'll be doing a talk called What to Do When Paleo Fails, kind of going through what context to put all this stuff into, testing, treatment, and all that. And that's pretty much the gist of it.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Ruscio and I will be drinking NorCal margaritas and probably starting a bar fight at PaleoFX. So it's going to be a good time. I'll be hiding behind him after the fracas ensues, though.
Looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, Doc, I'm super stoked to have you on again. I know there's going to be a ton of questions. Let's gun for 2 or 3 months down the road, and we'll get you back on for the third installment. Let's make this a regular gig.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks for having me on again, Rob.
Awesome, Doc. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.